Al Green, L-O-V-E, love. 29 minutes to 12 it is on 9 to noon. Now, our guest has taken his unusual experience of the September 11th attacks and turned it into a book about how to cope in times of adversity. The horror of that day unfolded as Elios Canaris was flying halfway across the Atlantic Ocean on his way from London to Chicago. Airspace across the United States was hurriedly shut down and his plane ended up being one of 38 that was diverted to Gander Airport in Newfoundland. The tiny town suddenly found more than 6,000 passengers and crew dumped on their doorstep overnight, and their pit stop was to last over a week. Elios has taken his experience and used it to write about the resilience in the face of adversity, something that probably resonates with many during this pandemic, including in Tamaki Makaurau, which is where Elios joins us now from the North Shore. Morena and happy level three.
Morena, Catherine, thanks for having me.
The small things matter at times like these, don't they? What an incredible, what an incredible story. And I don't know, I didn't know how many people are aware of what happened in Gander. I think it's been turned into a musical in the US, which is usually the sort of threshold for something amazing having happened. But is it very well known in New Zealand? Do you find people aware of it when you talk to them?
Very few people are aware of the musical. I know that it opened in Melbourne and just recently opened also in Sydney. But unfortunately, due to COVID and the pandemic, they had to shut that production down. I think we're getting more and more awareness of the musical. And recently, it was just aired on Apple TV. I'm hoping that people can get to see the musical because it is a true reflection of what we went through on a positive side.
20 years later and so raw for the most profoundly affected in the United States, still very raw in the psyche of that country, but for those who lost loved ones and for a city that went through what it went through. For you, has it taken time not only to process what you experienced, but to feel like it's the time to write about it?
Absolutely. I as you mentioned, the event happened 20 years ago, Catherine, and when you think about this, in 2014, that was nearly 13 years after the event, I was in America and I was talking at a conference there. And I met up some colleagues who were in the professional speaking industry and they asked me what I was speaking about. I tentatively said, I'm going to share my 9/11 experience. And when I shared a little bit, they said, wow, you should write a book about this. And to be honest, it was far too raw for me even back then. And it was only in 2020 when we went through our first lockdown that I started to piece together what I've been thinking about for, at that stage, 19 years to put together the book, which we launched earlier on this year.
Take us back to where you were and what was happening when this truly life-changing event for the globe, really, or certainly for the Western world, happened. And as we just see for the Middle East and for Afghanistan and for Iraq as well. But it really was one of those moments in history. And where were you in life and where were you travelling and why?
I was flying from London Heathrow to Chicago on a speaking tour, and I was halfway through the flight on United Airlines flight UA929. To be honest, I was more focused on writing a report, making sure that was done, when halfway through the flight, Captain Mike Ballard came on to give us the following announcement. He started off by stating, "Ladies and gentlemen, can I first reassure you there's nothing wrong with the aeroplane? However, there has been a significant incident, and Federal Aviation Authority has asked us to divert as they have shut down all international airspace." And that was literally all the information we had. So we were flying blind. And the first thought that went through my head was possibly somebody had assassinated the President of the United States. But that was quickly followed by a second, even more sinister thought that possibly somebody had dropped a nuclear bomb on US soil. It wasn't until we actually landed half an hour later that he explained what had happened and then piped in the BBC World Service for us to hear firsthand from them.
Well, you were probably ahead of many people in anticipating the scale of what had happened. As the plane landed, what are the thoughts going through your head?
Well, I honestly thought this is going to be a short layover. They're going to be here for maybe a couple of minutes, an hour or two, and then we'll be back in the air. But the seconds ticked into minutes, which ticked into hours. And soon we were 24 hours in the airplane on the tarmac. 37 other planes surrounded us, had landed all at Gander International Airport. And the town that had woken up 9,300 for breakfast was now catering for 16,000 people for supper. And as the time ticked on, we suddenly realized that we weren't going to be going home in a hurry.
What an incredible scene. New Finland, many of us have seen the images of it through some of the wonderful films. On the Annie Proulx Shipping News is always my entree to New Finland. But as you say, a comparatively small town and all these planes on the tarmac and all these people needed caring for. What happened?
Well, by the time they eventually allowed us to disembark, and it was 24 hours we were on the plane, the reason it took so long was twofold. First of all, they had to set up an immigration and a security system to take care and process all the passengers. Secondly, they had to figure out where we're going to place them, because there was no emergency plan that's been written for this sort of scenario. And I look at what I saw and I experienced from the local, the newfies, as we got to know them, was a group that came together in real adversity, who all linked arms to help us. They raided their pantries, they emptied the fridge, their freezer, so they could feed us. In fact, within a couple of days, we found ourselves being offered clothing, underwear, T-shirts, things like that, socks, just to keep us going.
I can only imagine what 24 hours on a plane is like. I know how bad it is, you know, even with the luxuries when you're flying, but just the way the temperature adjusts and the what happens to the air conditioning when you're stuck on the tarmac and just the tediousness of not going anywhere. Then you're taken into the embrace of these households. But of course, this is pre-smartphones. And the other big issue is trying to communicate with your own loved ones about what they're experiencing and about where you're at. How did that happen?
Well, we had earphones on the airplane itself, just on this sort of armrest beside the seat. And I had to try and get an outside line. And you were swiping your credit card and swiping it through, trying to just get a line out. It took me probably 3 hours to get hold of my wife back in New Zealand. But I was lucky enough to get hold of my parents in the UK and then some of my family in the States to, first of all, let them know that I was safe, but also to reassure me that they were also safe, because some of my family lived and worked close to New York City. So having that situation, it does run through your mind what's happening. But I have to say that the crew and the pilot for the United Airlines flight were really good at making us feel safe and keeping us calm. And I have to say that that helped the mood on the aeroplane, that we were quite a somber sort of plane, but we were able to quickly break down those barriers amongst us between all the different class of travel. I was flying in business class, but soon you were talking to people who were flying in economy as well as those in first class. It was truly a beauty to behold. Unfortunately, you did mention the air conditioning. Well, on landing, the air conditioning went out. So yes, we literally had an open door for the plane to allow some airflow. So it was quite a peculiar situation. We were even given the very wise instruction, do not try to leave the aeroplane, because it was a 20-foot drop.
We want to talk about leadership at the moment, and I think you've alluded to some already, which was the calmness of the captain in that situation, because people confined on an aeroplane, hearing about a disaster, things could, and then stuck there for 24 hours, things could have gone pear-shaped. But I just want to touch also on your own psychological experience of this. I know where I was on 9/11. I was travelling halfway across the world, a plane behind our Prime Minister, about to arrive in Europe and then turn around and come back again. And I know how discombobulating that experience was, trying to make sense not only of what had happened to 3,000 people and a city and a country, but what had happened to the world and what it was going to mean. Personally, what was running through your mind over this time?
Well, the first thought that I had was still in denial, because I thought we were going to be leaving very quickly. I had to write a report, so I was focused on that as the initial aspect. But soon I realized there are three principles which I have brought into my life today. And the first principle is that you have to take control of yourself first. And by doing that, you've got to ask for help. And I think that is so important, especially when we're going through university like we're doing right now, to make sure that you can reach out to people and ask for help as it's needed. The second thing is probably to build and expand your community. It doesn't matter whether you are leading a multinational organization or just leading yourself and your family. You've got to look out for others. And on the plane, we started to look out for each other. We were talking to other people and just making sure that they were okay, not just the person sitting in the seat next to you, but all those around us. And the third thing that I learned, and I had to do this quite quickly, was that we have to change the rules. Whatever was happening before has all changed. If you think about this, 9/11, the airline industry came to a collapse. Tourism in New York City evaporated overnight. The conference industry I was involved with suddenly stopped. Sorry, did I say 9/11? Because I could have said the global financial crisis. I could have said COVID or the earthquake in Christchurch or Delta. It is just equally as important for us to realize the rules are changing today as they did 20 years ago. But yet 20 years ago, we managed to get through this. And I'm hoping and praying that we can all come together and get through what we have to go through with Delta right now.
Tell me about the people of Gander. You've alluded to it already. They embraced you. They took you in. I think there were nearly 300,000 meals made over the course of the time you were there. But when it comes again to leadership and or just to human organisation, what did you learn from the experience of those people and their embrace of you?
Well, after we were disembarked and we literally went through immigration and security, we were asked to board a bus, and that took us a 40-minute journey to a small sleepy hollow called Gambo. And Gambo is where the Salvation Army hosted 198 of us plain people from that flight. The people from the Salvation Army showed us that you can bring humanity back out in a very dark time. And literally, as we were arriving, there was a lovely lady, her name was Teresa. She was the secretary of the Salvation Army. And she said, welcome to every single person as we walked through the doors of the Salvation Army. And that was continued by other members of their congregation, to the point that at close to midnight, that first night of the Salvation Army, I went into the hall to sit and write my report. One of the other congregation's members came and sat next to me. She would have been probably in her mid-60s at the time, and she started a short conversation. And I realized afterwards that she was really being a counselor to people like myself, just in case we needed somebody to talk to. And that was when I realized that maybe I should change my priorities. Instead of being production focused, I should be more relationship focused and think about the others around me. And that was a major lesson that I learned from this lovely grandmother who showed me her passport photos of her four grandkids. That was a life changer for me.
Another dimension here that I find fascinating, that there's thousands of you there in the small town, stranded on your planes and now in the community. Again, this is pre-smartphones where we could all text where we were and update everybody every second of the day where we were. What did you learn about this group that was in a crisis of sorts? It was certainly in a stressful situation, and how it behaved?
Well, I think that the people from Salvation Army and the locals went the extra mile for us. The first thing they did, as you rightly point out, smartphones weren't around back then, Catherine. So we had to put new landline phones into the Salvation Army, a new internet connection so we could actually connect through. We had the unenviable task. One of my fellow passengers, Bob Smith, who now lives in Perth, had the unenviable task of being a phone monitor, where he had to tell people you only have 2 minutes on the phone to speak with your loved ones. But yet, even though they provided this, when we offered to pay and recompense the Salvation Army, they said, no, this is on us. And it was like we were strangers when we landed. We became friends during the stay. By the time we left, We were family. And I truly understood the meaning of how Newfoundlanders really start to become family because of such a difficult environment that they have to live in. And that was quite considerable to observe.
This book you've penned, the latest one, Leading from the Stop, Positive Influence and Heartfelt Resilience in Times of Adversity, there's obvious parallels. You've alluded to some of the other crises that we've had in this country or had globally. We're currently in an unusual one with the pandemic. There's few things that have literally required cooperation and attention to basically every person on the planet as much as trying to stop a global pandemic. The old saying, we're not safe till everyone's safe. Developing nations who are so far behind on their vaccinations, if we enable that situation to continue, we risk further mutations of the virus. What are some of the key parallels between what you learned in this event and what we need to apply now?
If I look back, Catherine, at the experience, we had 198 passengers on the plane. We had our freedom. We were allowed to go out and walk outside of the Salvation Army and visit other people's homes where we had showers and things along those lines. But we knew that we were not going to be able to leave Gander and continue our journey back into the USA unless all the passengers were accounted for. So even a simple thing like creating a roster on the notice board. So if you were going to go out, you mentioned who you were, what time you're going out, where you're going to, and then sign yourself back in. So even a simple thing of, let's call it our team of 198, we had to look after each other. We had to link arms and go through together. So whilst it might be inconvenient to scan a QR code or do something along those lines, doing these little things actually helped us to get through this together. And then at the end of the day, we also had members of the passengers who were starting to entertain us. So Julian Dawson, on his way from London to Tennessee to record an album, he turned around and provided some entertainment, as did the kids and the locals. So we've got to make sure that we can ask for help, look out for others, and change those rules.
Elias, thank you. Elias Canaris.